Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
We are continuing to develop a new 1,000-bed ice processing center in the Houston area under a new 10-year contract we were awarded by ICE last year.
That's the sound of a phone call from an executive with Geo Group Incorporated. It's one of the biggest private companies that operates prisons, jails, rehabilitation facilities, and migrant detention facilities. Geo Group is a publicly traded company. And the takeaway, or really anybody interested in this stuff, was able to access this call, which was recorded in April, between Geo Group's executives and their investors.
What does the increase in Southwest border crossings mean for your business? And does the elevated occupancy of detainees within your facilities increase the likelihood of new contracts from ICE?
Well, there's been a steady increase in illegal border crossings, and it, I guess, parallels the steady increase of the census in our ICE facilities. And we expect that to continue to increase our occupancies and present opportunities for new facility contracts.
Illegal border crossings are up slightly from this time last year, but I do want to point out again that overall, they have dropped significantly over the last two decades. According to the Geo Group's annual report, the company made nearly $2.3 billion of total revenues in 2017 with their entire operation. And this election year, they've made political contributions to at least two congressmen from Texas who sit on the House Appropriations Homeland Security Subcommittee. And that subcommittee funds private immigration detention centers. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, who actually profits from immigration detention? Let's follow the money. Now let's take a step back. After intense pressure from the public and the media, President Trump reversed his own administration's policy yesterday to end family separation at the border. But it would still allow for the detention of children. They would remain detained with their parents. And the administration has not yet said whether the 2,300 children who were already separated from their parents would be reunited. But whether it be children or adults, there is significant increase in the number of people in immigration detention centers. And with that, companies stand to profit. Here to help us understand all this is Bianca Tylek, director of the Corrections Accountability Project.
One of the big draws of privatization, other than, you know, all the common misconceptions, we can do this cheaper, we can do this more efficiently, and all these things, is that it's really easy for private companies that are particularly abusive and exploitive to walk into spaces where people have fewer and fewer rights on a consistent basis. And so for the private sector in this space, they move into spaces quite effectively in places where people are not protected by the same level of laws and people are less likely to be sympathetic.
So we're talking about, I mean, there are many companies involved in this, but we're looking at CoreCivic and Geo Group. They are two of the largest and biggest for-profit entities. And just to be clear, there are also nonprofit entities that are involved in this space, as we're seeing as well. When we think about CoreCivic and Geo Group, what's their reputation when it comes to immigrant detention?
Okay, so CoreCivic and Geo Group are the single largest holders of immigrants in detention. About 40% of each of their businesses, slightly more than that, is actually federal contracts. And a large part of that is ICE and U.S. Marshals, but is essentially all these immigrants who are in detention. In fact, 65% of ICE beds are privatized. And so obviously, a big piece of that is being held at CoreCivic and Geo. Together, their revenues are over $350 million in 2017 for ICE detention alone. And their reputation, kind of largely on immigration and otherwise, stems back to a lot of exploitation and abuse, and they're consistently being sued on different for different reasons and different violations of human rights. There's a case right now that's out around their employment and I use that word very, very loosely, of immigrants in their detention centers for $1 a day. And these are people who are there for civil laws, right, not for criminal laws. And all of that simply helps these companies because it offsets their cost of running their facilities.
So, Bianca, you heard the call that we played at the top of the segment between investors and executives at the GEO Group. What's your response to that?
It's been long known that one of the things that these companies depend on, like GEO Group, are really stringent immigration laws, really stringent criminal laws. In fact, if you read their annual report, the risks that they list to their business are legalization of marijuana, immigration reform, and actually, I think one of the most interesting is one of their risks to their business is actually a reduction in crime. Their business model really depends on the loss of freedom of people, right? And so they rely on all of these laws that are particularly stringent, tough on crime and tough immigration laws, and actually play a deep role in creating them in the first place for their business. And so one interesting example, other than their annual report, which clearly states exactly what serves as risks to their business, last year there was a presentation, their sort of investor presentation that they give every few months. In, I want to say, June of 2017, they had already stated that they were looking forward to the executive order that will stop catch and release, which is interesting because we're now talking about that as something that came into effect a few weeks ago. And it was something that they were planning on a year ago, right? And they had already had information and a deep understanding of what exactly this administration was going to do to benefit their business model. And they have actually dramatically increased the number of beds. In fact, DHS stated that they would increase the number of beds in immigration detention by almost 500%. And we are now in that place where on a daily basis, GEO Group or CoreCivic are holding roughly 15,000 people in immigration detention.
So the question I think that folks who agree with these policies would say one of two things. First of all, we need law and order. These laws are important, right? If people are breaking the law, then they need to be detained. That's question number one. Question number two is, I think, you know, someone needs to do it, right? Someone needs to, we need a place to put people who have broken the law. What is the difference between that and what's happening on the ground?
It's interesting because your question, the two questions can sort of almost be answered together, which is that what people don't understand is that so much of what we believe is a crime in this country is actually dictated by corporate interest. And a good example of that is the legalization of marijuana. The three biggest lobbies against the legalization of marijuana are alcohol, pharmaceuticals, and private prisons. And so the same thing happens on immigration. They play a big role, and they've lobbied, used a ton of money to lobby around immigration, which is super important and has dictated a lot of the ways, the directions in which immigration comes. I mean, like, let's not forget, they wildly invested in this particular administration.
When you say invested in, you mean donated to?
Correct. Donated to, contributed to. In fact, private prison companies were, that industry was the single largest winner in the market on November 9th in 2016. Their stocks went up over 60%.
And we're talking about whose stocks?
Specifically CoreCivic and GEO Group. And so those two, their stocks, like I said, were the most winning stocks on the stock market the following day.
So I want to pivot for a second with that in mind to what's happening on the ground today at the border with these images and the separation of, up until yesterday. I mean, we know this could change on a dime, but there have been more than 2,000 children placed in these detention facilities. Do we know how much the Trump administration is spending on these detention facilities? And if so, who won these contracts and essentially at what cost?
So I want to be a little clear. Children are not necessarily being held in some of the same types of detention facilities. A lot of the detention facilities that we're talking about, some of the family detention facilities are privatized, are largely privatized, and certainly all the immigration detention facilities are not all, but a very significant portion have been privatized. Where the children are being held has been differing reports in which, you know, we're not on the ground there in Texas and Arizona and California, where the majority of these families and children are being held. But some are being held at nonprofits. And in theory, the children are also supposed to be going to HHS. And so, but with that said, in terms of like who's benefiting from these facilities and how much the federal government is spending, again, I would say there's been several new contracts that have been given out to largely like some nonprofits. There's a nonprofit called Southwest Key that is running one of the big facilities down there.
And how big is that contract? Because I was surprised to see that there were nonprofits involved mm-hmm. in this issue. I mean, right. In some ways I understand it because I'm assuming that these organizations have social services elements. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But at the same time—
And that contract for the children is not going to be with the Department of Homeland Security in the way that the one for parents or the immigration detention will be. It's largely with HHS, right, with the health department. But the other facilities where you're holding like either family detention or immigration detention with the parents and all of those, we do know that at least CoreCivic and GEO in 2017 pocketed more than $350 million for like specifically for ICE detention. And so while I don't know precisely what the contract is for Southwest Key, even though I saw something about a $450 million like contract and a few others, we do know that there's a ton of money being spent.
The latest iteration of this policy, yesterday the president essentially rolled back some of the policy of family-child separation. But now, from my understanding, the families are going to be detained together, but they'll still be detained, which means that these centers will continue to exist. Yep. Correct?
That's correct. And so that's, you know, that's one of the reasons you'll probably be seeing a lot of things going around through the advocacy circles and on the news about, you know, the solution to separation of families is not family detention. But that's exactly what is going to happen at this point. Children will be allowed to remain with their parents. But the children will still be in detention.
And by extension, will that mean that because they're not in separate children facilities, will that mean that they'll be in these immigration detention facilities that are run by these larger companies, not
Correct.
Nonprofits?
Right. And so they have what we call family detention centers, and a lot of those are run by private entities.
Bianca Tylik is the director of the Corrections Accountability Project. Bianca, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We reached out to GEO Group for comment and have not yet heard back. Despite the president's executive order on Wednesday, the more than 2,300 children already separated from their parents may not immediately be reunited. But it was a groundswell of vocal opposition that brought about the president's decision to undo his administration's policy in the first place, opposition from people who we don't often think of as traditional opponents to the president or the Republican Party. On June 1st, a coalition of evangelical groups sent a letter to President Trump asking him to protect the unity of immigrant families. And this week, religious leaders from across the country came to D.C. to meet with politicians and to advocate an end to the family separation crisis. Reverend Alan Cross was among them. A self-described lifelong Republican, Cross is a Southern Baptist minister from Montgomery, Alabama. I spoke with Reverend Cross about how he got interested in immigration and why he believes faith leaders need to continue to speak out.
I was pastoring in Montgomery, Alabama, and there was an immigration bill that was passed in Alabama called HB 56, and I had not been paying much attention to that. One day, I just decided to read the bill because I was hearing about it in the news, and when I read the bill, I saw multiple provisions that actually affected religious liberty. There was a ministry that we were doing to immigrants in our community that had now become illegal with the law, like if we transport anyone from one place to another, if we had state workers who didn't turn in undocumented immigrants, things like that, then they could lose their jobs or we could be afoul of the law. And when I saw that, I became concerned. How could a law pass in Alabama with all of our churches and, you know, the presence of Baptists being so strong and we care about religious liberty? How could that pass without us even looking to see if this affected the ministry of our churches? So that's what initially got me thinking about this. And then I began to look into the whole situation. I started listening. This is around 2011, 2012, and started looking into what was happening with immigration. And as I studied and read, I became pretty alarmed by what I was finding. And so that alerted me. Then I began to study the scriptures and see what the Bible said about it, and that began to change my thinking on how I saw the immigration situation.
So many questions on that front. I want to reference the Bible in a minute, going back to Attorney General Sessions. But before that, the president is the party of family values, right? At least that was one of the platforms that the party generally has run on. How does this reconcile with that idea of family values?
You know, I'm a lifelong Republican voter and conservative, and have always appreciated that aspect of the Republican Party and of the conservative movement. But, you know, it's easy for us sometimes to see family values related to our own families and to families that we know. And we sometimes don't extend those same values to others or to people we don't know or maybe to people that we think might be a threat. And so I think that's the concern, that if we really do believe in family values, that we apply that to all people. And that's something that I think that the church, especially Southern Baptists at this point, and other evangelicals are beginning to speak out on and say this is important, that we extend the same values to all families.
Now, Attorney General Jeff Sessions used a verse from the Bible, I believe it was Romans 13, to justify the zero tolerance policies that are taking place at the U.S.-Mexico border.
If you violate the law, you subject yourself to prosecution. And I would cite you to the Apostle Paul and his clear and wise command in Romans 13 to obey the laws of the government, because God has ordained the government for his purposes.
As a clergy member, what are your thoughts on that?
Right. Well, he was referencing Romans 13, 1 through 7. And, you know, this is an important passage as part of Scripture. It's something we believe, that we should give respect to government. But this isn't a free pass for government to do whatever it wants and for the church to submit to that. We live by a higher law, which is God's law. And it's our job to hold government accountable to what is right and what is good and what is moral and just according to Scripture. We have a mandate as Americans, but also in Scripture, to be able to speak with a voice, to call for justice and to call for what's right.
And when you look at what's happening at the border right now, why have we, in addition to the president's rhetoric, what else do you think is driving this lack of empathy, quite frankly, towards the people who are currently at the border?
I think we often have a tendency to fear what we don't know and to fear what we don't understand. And then we're told that these people are a threat, their future MS-13, their future gang members. And so that fear of trying to protect and defend our way of life often seems to override what is the biblical call, that we lay down our life for others, that we consider others better than ourselves, and we look after the interests of others, not just our own. That's what Scripture calls us to do. That's what Christianity is about. It's what Jesus did for us, that he laid down his life for us, that we would have salvation.
But that
salvation
seems to be
him.
Getting lost, Reverend. I mean, that seems to be something where we're now at a place in American history where we have over 2,000 children who have been separated from their families.
So we have to speak. It is getting lost. And so we have to make that case. That's what Southern Baptists did last week in a resolution on immigration, where we made that case. 9,000 Southern Baptists gathered representing 15 million Southern Baptists. And we made the case on immigration. These people have worth and value, and we should love them and consider them and welcome them and incorporate them as best we can. We want people to come legally in the right way. Everyone wants that. But we don't need to fear people, and we don't need to push people away.
And your parishioners, are there conversations that you're having with the congregation about how to approach this difficult topic?
Right. You know, like I said, I work with a lot of pastors and churches now. I'm not pastoring the church that I was pastoring before, because I'm working on broader issues. You know, I was concerned for a long time about whether or not evangelicals would ever speak on an issue because there was such, you know, support kind of across the board. But I think we're seeing that happen now. I'm definitely hearing people say, what can we do about this? How can we speak into this? And then I'm also hearing people say, this is, you know, they've come illegally, and what happens, and, you know, they shouldn't have come in the first place. And so there is definitely conversation happening about what is the way forward. But more and more, I am hearing people in Alabama and the South who are saying this issue is a bridge too far.
Reverend, is this a selective morality from the religious community? What about people who are suffering, say, in Puerto Rico? Did it take this for the church to say, now is the time?
Yeah, and again, you know, trying to speak for everyone is problematic. I know people who, you know, Christians and Baptists who have been to Puerto Rico to help. There's a consistent desire to help people. I mean, what triggers outrage and what triggers people to say, okay, you know, as a policy level, this has to change.
Thank you.
you know, that's difficult to speak to with the Puerto Rico situation. You know, things were happening over time and we were, you know, given assurances that everything was okay. And so for a lot of people, I think paying attention, it didn't spike at a level that, you know, that caused people to really understand what was happening, at least if they weren't connected to it. This is a little bit different where you do have visible images of parents and children, and you're seeing children taken away from parents. And that's something, again, you know, going back to your original question about family values, I think that that triggers kind of a deep response from evangelical Christians where we're saying this should not be.
Alan Cross is a Southern Baptist minister from Montgomery, Alabama. Reverend Cross, thank you again.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating and review us on iTunes. It helps us in ways you can't imagine. Also, tell your friends. Share this podcast on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you want your followers to get some solid news coverage. They'll be smarter and they'll think you're a hero. It's a win-win. All right, now back to the show.
Last month, a bloc of House Republicans unexpectedly joined House Democrats in voting against the 2018 Farm Bill. The move was part of an effort by those Republicans to challenge House Speaker Paul Ryan to hold a vote on a separate conservative immigration bill. Now a second vote is scheduled for today on the very same Farm Bill. The final bill that's passed could have a significant impact on more than 2 million farmers across the country. Javier Zamora is an organic farmer who owns JSM Organic Farms in Aromas, California. Javier, thanks for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me here.
So you grew up in a farming family, and now you have ownership of the farm. Tell us a little bit about the work that you do and the size of your farm and operation.
Well, thank you. I come from a farming family in Mexico. I came to the States when I was 20 years old, and I now own a small organic, certified organic farm in Aromas, California that grows strawberries, vegetables, raspberries, and organic flowers. So what we do, we grow a lot of food for thousands of people now. The size of the farm has gone from an acre and a half in 2012 to close to 100 acres now, and about 20, 25 employees work at my farm.
And are you watching the debate over the farm bill?
I do, as much as the time allows me to, but there are quite a few things that will impact small organic growers as myself with these weather conditions that are a little crazy sometimes, and we get a lot of rains. You don't have the ability to sometimes put in practices erosion controls. And in my area here, we most of us farm on hills that when we get big rains like we got a couple of years ago, all the soil washes down the hill. Therefore, programs that are part of the NRCS now, the EQUIT program that allows us to preserve our natural resources better, wouldn't be here. So the impact is not only environmental, but also in the community economical.
And I've been in that region. I've been to the small organic farms. I've seen the much larger Driscoll farms as well. Is there a sense that this farm bill would benefit larger farms, industrial farms, or smaller growers like yourself?
Well, obviously, there is no secret that, you know, the bigger fish eats the little fish, but certain things that are part of the farm bill allow small growers to benefit from, you know, the big pool of money that gets allocated or spent every 4 years or whenever the farm bill gets put in place. And there's always, you know, there's always the fight of among the big ones, and the little ones sometimes, like myself, get forgotten. So every opportunity that we get to talk about what we do and the impact that we actually have in our communities and the thousands of people that are fed out of our small farms, the many, many people that get employment out of these small guys, like myself, makes a big difference. So we have to make sure that everybody gets a little bit of the pie and not just gets not just the larger guys get the bigger piece of the piñata.
having been in that region and having reported on that area, and particularly with farmers, many of the farmers in that area are also Latino. Many of the farm owners in that area, both of larger scale farms and smaller scale farms like yourself. Is that a different experience with this administration being a Latino farmer versus not being one?
Well, the very first thing, we definitely don't have enough. The percentages of farmers in my community, I mean, 90-some percent are Latinos, and maybe the percentage of ownership of land is very, very small. One of my goals is to continue making things a little more easier for others to maybe become owners of part of the land. I'm one of those blessed individuals that, you know, things have happened for me really fast that I now own a little piece of land. So I just want to make sure that others that have not been as blessed and have not been heard can have the opportunity to own some of this beautiful land that they're working.
Javier Zamora is an organic farmer who owns JSM Organic Farms in Aromas, California. Javier, thanks for joining us.
Muchas gracias. Adios.
A usted. Imagine you're a refugee, newly arrived in the United States. The federal government gives your family financial assistance for 90 days. If you get placed in Maryland, the International Rescue Committee steps in to give you assistance for 8 months. And those first 8 months are the subject of a new documentary, This Is Home, a refugee story.
طلعنا من سوريا بال 2013. كنت حامل بابني الصغير.
We got out of Syria in 2013. I was pregnant.
Pregnant?
My youngest. Everything around us had closed. I had to give birth. There were no hospitals. I was having lunch with my kids and a bomb hit our house. We decided to leave after our house was bombed. The journey from Syria to Jordan was tough.
You were on the application list for 2 years?
Yes.
You chose Baltimore or?
No, they chose it.
They meaning the UN?
They chose the state of Maryland and the city of Baltimore.
We're here to help you in every possible way, but our assistance is temporary. By the end of 8 months, you'll need to rely on yourselves.
Hopefully.
This Is Home follows families of Syrian refugees in Baltimore, including Madiha, who you just heard talking to Sausen, the senior resettlement supervisor at the IRC's Baltimore office. Alexandra Shiva directed This Is Home.
It's a very intense period of time. So they're told over and over again, you really have 8 months. You have to have a job. You have to, you know, learn the language as much as you can. You really have to be on your feet. We won't be here. It's not that we won't be here at all, but we will not be here to, you know, translate for you and take you places and explain things to you in that same way. And it's very overwhelming. I mean, I think if I moved from New York City to Baltimore, it would take me 2 years to get adjusted. So the idea of someone coming from another country, another culture, and having 8 months to be self-sufficient it's an incredible hurdle.
And it, not just someone coming from another country, but these are, you know, refugees who are coming from really desperate situations, right?
Yeah. I mean, they are coming with a lot of trauma and a lot of pain and a lot of loss. And what I learned through the process of making the film was just how much they all miss home, but there isn't a home to go back to. So they are in a psychic in-between that's very, very painful.
And of course, we're seeing now an increase in the charged rhetoric, if you will, coming from the Trump administration, mostly against immigrants, refugees, Muslims, etc. This isn't a new thing, right? This feeling, this anti-immigrant feeling, isn't necessarily new. Were the folks that you profiled feeling that in any way?
They didn't talk about it at first. I think that they felt it when the Muslim ban happened. They definitely felt an increase. Madiha had an experience on the bus where someone tried to grab at her hijab. You know, she actually started wearing, someone gave her an American flag hijab to wear for protection. So she started wearing that, and that made her feel more comfortable. You know, they're dealing with so much, and it's the last thing they need to deal with is that. But I think that more often than not, they were very focused on the kids, school, acclimating, getting a job, trying to pay the rent and provide for their families. But, you know, they definitely noticed. They noticed as things increased.
And is there a sort of a feeling of disillusionment with the United States?
I think, you know, less so because of the political climate and more so because of the cultural differences. I think that that's a big shift for, you know, I always talk about in this film the idea that there's a dignity preservation piece for the men, that it's very, very difficult for them to come to a place where they're told, you know, not only are you going to be shaking hands with women and you're going to be speaking to women in a totally different way, but your wives are going to have to work. You're not going to be able to provide for your family. And culturally, I think it's very complex. For the women, one of our subjects, Yasmin, loves that she gets to drive, and not that she couldn't before, but she didn't. She's learning how to drive, and she's excited to work. Madiha actually finds it much more complicated because she feels it takes her away from being the kind of mother that she wants to be, which is, it's just a different kind of conflict here. And I think that's part of the disillusionment for them, is just how hard it is, how expensive it is. These are people who used to have all of their family living within a few blocks. So now they have family all over the world, scattered all over the world, many who are still in Syria. And I do think that in the political climate, to know that your family cannot come join you, it's not an option, is very painful.
And this sort of feeling, I mean, the name of the documentary is This Is Home. Is it?
You know, maybe one day it will be. I think many of them came for their children. Is it home? You know, I think home is a complicated concept, and it's in your DNA. And I think that they all miss Syria, and I think that they miss a place that doesn't really exist anymore. So this will have to be home is really the idea.
At the same time, your film also balances a lot of these really complicated issues with humor. And there are lots of scenes and where, you know, there's laughter and just, you mentioned Yasmin driving. How did you balance telling, you know, showing that with also keeping the tone that's so important for this documentary?
I mean, I believe that humor is part and parcel with resilience. And so the idea that you don't show people, they're laughing at the absurdity. People continue to laugh as long as we are trying to be alive. You know, you have to have all of the different emotions. And it was very important in the editing and in filming to be able to mine for the intimacy and those sort of small moments that I think make you feel connected and that are moving toward similarity rather than difference. And humor is one of those things. And they really are. I mean, there are some incredibly funny moments, and they are the ones laughing. You know, there's the scene where these two of the men, one of them is trying to say the word construction in English, and the other one says, I think it's going to be easier for him to change his profession instead.
And are you still in touch with the family?
Yes. In fact, I was just in Baltimore and saw most of them, and it was really wonderful. I see them a lot and speak to them very often, and they're doing very, very well.
Alexandra Shiva is an award-winning filmmaker and director of the documentary This Is Home, A Refugee Story. Alexandra, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The film premieres on Epix tomorrow. And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Now, if you want to get in on the action, just text the word START, START, to 69866. Standard data and messaging rates apply. And you can always text the word STOP to opt out. Again, text START, 69866. And what we'll do is we'll send you a few text messages a week about topics we're discussing on our show, and maybe you'll end up on air. Thanks so much for listening, and happy official start of summer on this longest day of the year. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
How did we get from this?
Build that wall! Build that wall! Build that wall!
To this?
One by one, we are finding the gang members, the drug dealers, and the criminals who prey on our people.
To this?
If you're smuggling a child, then we're going to prosecute you. And that child will be separated from you, probably.
The politics behind immigration policy and what it could all mean for Election Day. I'm Amy Walter, and that's next time on the Takeaway Podcast.